You're listening to PROX.
I gotta feel, you know how actors like feel like they gotta, you know, really be in the person before they can start really acting. Like they gotta really like know the person. Yeah, I feel like that as a writer.
Totally.
I feel like that as a writer. I gotta know it. I mean, I think that's more important actually than structure and all of the other stuff that I do have to do. But you know, all of that is like me, like, you know, getting that figured out. But can you actually be in this place and convince yourself that you're there? Forget other people. Do you believe it?
Yes.
Do you believe this happened? You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what you got to do.
You're listening to In Proximity. This is the second part of a conversation between writer Ta-Nehisi Coates and Proximity founder Ryan Coogler. If you haven't listened to part one, you may want to press pause right here. Go back to the previous episode and check it out. Then come back here when you're done. Last episode, Ta-Nehisi shared a little bit about his early writing experiences and the impact of hip-hop on his work as a writer. On this episode, Ta-Nehisi and Ryan dive into Ta-Nehisi's writing process, their shared experiences in writing the character of T'Challa, the Black Panther, pivotal moments in their life and work as artists, and of course, their Prox Rex.
Just in terms of process, man, because you've been writing for you've been a professional writer, bro, for how long?
Most of my life.
Because I remember when
27 years.
27 years.
27
I
years.
When I met Chadwick for the first time.
I mean, in some sense longer, but yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I met Chadwick for the first time, and I mentioned you, and he was the first person to tell me how to say your name the right way. Because I think I wanted to pronounce it Ta-Nehisi.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah, I know Ta-Nehisi.
That's the most Chad shit ever.
Yeah, he just fixed it for me.
Right. Subtly.
Yeah, he fixed it real subtly, but firmly. You know what I'm saying? And he mentioned like that people knew you were really good at writing. Like, and he kind of said it like you went pro early.
Mm.
You like went to the pros early or whatever. You know, like while everybody was kind of still in school, you kind of went pro. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, to extend the metaphor, you know, it's like you failing out of school, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what happened. You know, I wasn't a good student. I was a terrible student. And yeah, I was a really bad student, Coog.
What do you mean by that, bro?
I mean, if you want to get particularly deep with it, what I now realize is I was like ADHD.
Undiagnosed.
Definitely. I mean, that wasn't really a thing that was like...
And you've been diagnosed since?
Yeah. Yeah, right. I have. And I knew it. It was a point when I knew it. And then I was like, all right, I'm just going to, you know, go on with my life. And then I, you know, actually relatively recently talked to somebody and they was like, yeah, that's you right there. I could not sit in a classroom and listen to somebody talk for an hour and a half, which was my Tuesdays and Thursdays in college. You know,
what would you find yourself doing?
Oh, I'm thinking about other things. Mine's going all kinds of places, you know, and then I got to sit down to do a paper and my mind is going like 50 different places. And, you know, the language we had for back then was, are you lazy? You know what I mean? Are you lazy? You know, and that was like the book on me when I was in school. You know, I was a terrible high school student and, you know, middle school student. You know what I mean? Really elementary school student, probably. It's like Ta-Nehisi is really, really, really smart. He reads so much. But he's so lazy. He's not living up to his potential. He's not. And that was like the constant thing. And so I got to college and it was like, I was interested in everything I was interested in the classroom sometimes, but I was interested in everything outside of the classroom. But not like normal. I mean, I was just likely to go in the library and just read a book, you know, for myself. You know what I mean? Like I was just as likely to do that. And so something just wasn't fitting. And it took a long time for me to, you know, realize I probably wasn't going to get my degree. You know, I was in and out. You know what I mean? I was back, you know.
So what Chad was talking about, you going pro, was from your perspective, was kind of out of necessity.
I was forced. Wow. You know what I mean? I grew up in a kind of household where you wasn't going to really come back. So, you know what I mean? You got to make a way. And so probably the first thing was I got published really early.
Yeah.
Like I published poetry like in an actual book. That somebody else put together, like an anthology, like my freshman year.
Because that's how he phrased it. He didn't phrase it like you were like a bad student. He said you were so good.
Yeah, he wouldn't have known that though. He wasn't in class with me. He was in fine arts.
That's what I'm saying. But he said like the rap on you around campus was that you were really great, like this great writer.
That's what they would have seen. That was the exterior.
That's wild, bro.
But you know, the interior is, yo, I'm fucking up. Like I'm just I'm fucking up my life right now. You know what I mean? Like my parents sent me to do one thing and I'm really not doing it. And it's like, y'all always tell people you really should not write unless you feel like you got no other choice on some level. Wow. Yeah. On some level. Like, you know what I mean? Like, cause it's just, and that's how I felt. I felt like I didn't have any other choice. So I started, you know, I published poetry. I actually started in journalism at the student newspaper, which I loved. And then we had a kind of alternative paper in DC called Washington City Paper. I started, and you asked me like I was 20 years old when I got my first like job there. That was 27 years ago.
Jesus.
And
So you've worked professionally as a writer for longer than you haven't at this point.
Yeah, definitely. And to be clear, like as a writer, and I'm making this delineation, but very specifically as a journalist. And the reason why I'm making that delineation is because when you're a journalist, you have to go out and talk to people, like interview people. And like, dude, I can't even legally drink. But
wow.
I would go and interview.
You can't even meet somebody at a bar.
I can't meet somebody at a bar. But I would interview like people like, you know what I mean? Like literally twice, three times my age. You know what I mean? And you gotta formulate questions. Like you gotta really like think about like why. Like you can't just, because they won't respect you if you don't do that.
And what was your process like? What was you prep before you went in?
I did. I at that point, you know, and at that point, like internet is just beginning, but it can't really be depended upon. At the public library in Washington, where I was in school, they had something called Washingtonia, which was like basically an archive of everything written on local Washington, D.C., the city. I'm not talking about the capital. I'm talking about local Washington, D.C. And I just would spend hours down there. I would spend hours reading whatever, you know, to make sure I was informed. And I didn't even perceive it as work. It was like, who wouldn't want to do this? Who wouldn't want to sit here and just, you know, be able, hey, can you bring me that? Hey, I'd like to see that. Hey, this was published. Can you bring this over here? You know what I mean? And get to just sit there and absorb the information. So, you know, it's funny, man. My wife, before we were even dating, that we knew each other, she has a story about how she was like cutting on TV one day. And she looks, and it was the show that used to come on called Evening Exchange. And it would be like whatever the debates that were going on in the city. And she cut on the TV and she said, yo, that's Ta-Nehisi. And I was on TV because I had written this story. You know what I mean?
Awesome, bro.
And she, you know, she popped the VHS in. She was like, oh, shit, I got to pop the VHS in. You know,
taped
she's back
it.
In the day.
Yeah, I got to tape this.
I got to tape this. You know what I mean? Ain't no YouTube. I got to tape this real quick. And she had it for years. You know what I mean? And I had written about why we couldn't get what we now have, but a Museum of African-American History at the Smithsonian. And I had done all this report and I talked to all, again, you know, people three times, people who are actually gone at this point. You know, three times
and,
older.
And what you're talking about exists now.
It exists now. And in fact, one of the guys I interviewed for that story, Lonnie Bunch, was the first dude to run it.
Wow.
That's how long I've been writing.
Man, that's incredible. That's incredible, bro.
Yeah. I was a child, Coog. I was a child. Bro, I was younger than my son is right now. That's how young I was. Jesus.
Talk about the transition in the fiction,
mm-hmm.
You know, because I don't want to call it creative writing because journalism is as creative as it gets, especially some of the things that you've done and an inflection point for me in our relationship. I want to talk about is like, you know, I was doing a lot of traveling for work when I first got started, made Fruitvale, and I got bought by a distributor, and I'm going around the festivals and to promote and spend a lot of time in airports, you know, and I remember walking into one of the airport newsstands. I can't remember what airport I was in, but I saw a case for reparations. That was my first intro to you as a writer, mm-hmm. You know? And I remember how bold the cover was.
Yeah.
And it had all your black name on there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all black cover, had your name on there. And the way that it was presented was like, I feel like I should know who this guy is. You know what I'm, you know what I'm saying? Cause like it felt like your name was as big as the you know, and it was, and it was like, hey, we got this thing from this guy. And it's like, damn, I gotta get up on my stuff. I don't know who this guy is, but I wanna read this special edition. So I copped it and I read it. And man, it was so moving. Mm. You know, and it played back into like what I was talking a little bit about with Pac, this feeling that we had like in basically our whole lives, that like something was afoot that we couldn't put our finger on.
That you can't name.
Yeah, like, you know, obviously we were made very aware of the transatlantic slave trade and the Great Migration. No, we weren't calling it that, you know what I'm saying? But we knew that, like, yeah, all our grandparents seem to be from the same place and it ain't here, you know what I'm saying? but what had happened since, you know what I'm saying? It was like this thing happening and we were smart, bro. Like, I was a finance major in college. I couldn't put my finger on, like, the unfairness of what was happening in the housing crisis. I couldn't put my finger on it, man. And I couldn't put my finger on how there were neighborhoods in Oakland that I had never been. You know what I'm saying? Even though it's like down the street, it's a neighborhood over there, man. I think it's still Oakland, but like we don't go over there. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? What's going on there? Mm-hmm. And it's nicer and the houses are more valuable. You know, I hadn't understood what redlining was and how it was all a part of like the same thing, you know, happening, and how it was this great violation. You know what I'm saying? Like in a country where it's totally understood that, hey, if I do something to you, you know what I'm saying? And it's proven in a court of law, I have to compensate you for that. You know, that's known fact. We operate under that idea. And nobody had laid it out like with just beautiful prose. You know what I mean? I was really amazed. And then you took the Panther job. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Between the World and Me became in between those things. Mm-hmm. But you taking that Panther job was really the big cause of our intersection. Mm-hmm. That was when I asked Jesse Williams to introduce us. Mm-hmm. You know, because I was getting ready to take that movie. But can you talk a little bit about like the transition to writing fiction from being a journalist?
I mean, cool. I think it go back to what we talked about, where we started at the beginning of this conversation. I think if you coming up don't recognize the lines between things, you know what I'm saying? Like, why would you as an artist recognize a line between things? You know what I mean? Like, right. Why would you say, oh, I can't do that, you know? I mean, obviously, you got to master the form and learn it. You know what I mean? But
right.
You know, I've been a big comic book fan when I was a kid. When I was a kid, there was no ongoing Panther run at the time. So I didn't really know at that point a ton about Black Panther. I was a huge like Spider-Man, X-Men fan. And you know what's wild? It was something exciting about the fact that they had called me up. Like on some level, somebody said, oh, you called a black guy to do Black Panther. But actually, it was something exciting about the fact that they called me up to do something that I didn't have to exist as a fan. Like I didn't have memories. I didn't have like these deep, you know what I mean, fan-based memories. You know, I wrote Panther and Captain America for them, you know, which were two totally different books. But I guess what I would say is it was no different than the story I just told you about being like 20 years old and sitting in the public library in Washingtonia. It's like, okay, here you go. Go through everything on Black Panther and on T'Challa ever written. And then you come up with a take. Figure out who this guy is.
Right.
You know, and my take was this is a dude who spends a lot of time outside of Wakanda, like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was in the Avengers. At that point in time, the way the canon worked, he had gone to school outside of Wakanda. You know what I mean? He had taken Daredevil's place for a while. All this time.
Yeah.
Married this woman that wasn't from Wakanda. You know what I mean? Other love interests not from Wakanda. And I was like, does this man like being king?
Yeah.
I don't think he does. I don't think he does. I think he may recognize it's the thing that he has to do, but I don't think he loved being king. And I was like, oh, okay. All right. And I have to be honest. It's interesting. That also kind of, like you said, like Case for Reparations had come out, Between the World and Me had come out. What was happening at that point is I was getting some things that I probably had not thought I was asking for.
Mm-hmm.
But they came with the territory. And
What you're talking about is like, Is you talking about fame?
For lack of a better term, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think also, more specifically, so when we were working on Between the World and Me, you know, my editor was like, look, we got to get some blurbs. You know what I mean? I was like, and blurbs are like advertisement. Like, you know, people say, this is great. This is incredible.
Yep.
It's always a pain in the neck because you got to send shit to a bunch of other writers and ask them to tell the world about how great you are, right?
Yeah, the blurb,
I was like,
yeah.
You know, and he said, okay, all right, if you could get it from anybody, who would you get? And I named two people. One of them was E.L. Doctorow, who was like, you know, one of my idols and is one of my idols, even though he passed. And the other was Toni Morrison, you know what I mean? Also was an idol. Right. So I said, they're the only two who I, you know, could really think about who I really, really, you know, feel like it. And I didn't think they was going to do it. You know, it turned out E.L. Doctorow was sick at the time, ended up passing away. He couldn't do it. But then we got back this incredible note from fucking Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
I mean, at, you know, at that point, greatest living writer at that point. You know what I mean? Like, really, you know what I mean? It may have been like, you know, there's one other person I'm thinking about who somebody might have made the case for. But, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you're talking like, totally. like you know, incredible. And she says this thing. And she says, you know, look, I, you know, I think, you know, I've been searching for, you know, who was going to be James Baldwin. You know, who's going to be, had a place that James Baldwin had, right? And clearly from this book, it's Ta-Nehisi Coates. And I was like, being a dummy, I saw that and I was like, wow, this is really humbling. This is incredible. This means I really, really got to work hard. I can't ever take no shorts because if Toni Morrison says this, I get. But see, what I didn't understand was how that would be received. Like outside.
From the community.
From the community. Yeah, I didn't really, you know what I mean? And specifically be from other writers, you know what I mean, in my community.
It can make you a target for some hate.
I just say it can make you a target.
Yeah.
I just say it can make you a target. You know what I'm saying? And I'll just say, you know, it makes you, you know, it definitely makes you a target. And it did. Then the book blew up. And so, like, all of this is going into, like, me going into Panther. And it's like, well, I love to write. I really, God, I love to write. I really, really do. I love this book. Yeah. I feel great about it. I'm glad a lot of people saw it. But there was a thing going on in terms of how I was regarded, I think, you know, in the community of black writers that I just didn't love at all. I didn't love it all. Yeah, so I channeled a lot of that.
And just clarification for the podcast, man. I'm from where, like, the home of player hating as a concept. and it's a verb that comes out of jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's really like, so like, man, they hating. Where we from, it mean like, man, you jealous of a person. So you saying things or doing things to disparage them out of jealousy because you want their position or you feel like you should have what they have, right. You know. And that's what I mean by hate. I don't mean like, you know, you're a target for people hating you. But yeah, like, no, that's the thing that comes with. That's the thing that comes with success, right?
It does.
The great Denzel Washington told me, he said, when you pray for rain, you got to be prepared for the mud, which I translate as like when you wishing for a blessing, sometimes a blessing can have unintended consequences.
One of the things I've begun to think about is, in what just world do you get something, do you get a blessing and it not come with challenges? Like what kind of world do you want to live in? Like what are you asking for? You asking for just strawberry shortcake every day? Then you gotta kind of accept what it is, whether you ask for it or not. And
yeah,
it's kind of where I came out with T'Challa too. You know, like really, wow. I guess kind of where I came out with him. You know,
right, man. That's heavy, man. It's a character that I love so much, bro. The character in my world, like. I write, you know, whether it's by myself or with a co-writer, you know what I'm saying? On the Panther films, I wrote them with the great Joe Robert Cole. And then you get people to play these roles, you know what I'm saying? And so yeah, I love the character. You know, I love the character that you wrote, the character that Priest wrote, like, you know, Reggie McGregor, you know what I'm saying? Like, Stan, like I think he's just an incredible concept.
Mm-hmm.
And in that tapestry that of all of the works that have been done around the character, I think yours stands up extremely tall. You know?
I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
You just feel so real in your run. But for me, man, like, I think about that character and the impact that character's had on our lives, you know, and I'll be forever thankful for the opportunity to work with Chad. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, cool. We're all thankful to you, though. And I'm just saying as comic book writers, you know, I just think, bro, it is not an easy thing to translate that to the screen. People don't remember this, but like, let's say before, I don't know how you would date the current era of superhero movies, but if you take it, let's say we start with what, maybe Blade, that's probably the real thing. Probably the first Blade, the Wesley Snipes Blade, maybe. It was a lot of bad superhero movies, dude, and a lot of bad superhero TV shows, and it was not all because they didn't have the special effects yet. You know, it's actually a difficult thing to translate that into film, given what film requires in terms of believability. And I just, like, not just the fact that you did it, but what I was talking about earlier, like this need to say something. You know what I mean? That you was able to say something through T'Challa, through N'Jataka also. You know what I mean? It's just not, not a small thing. Both you and Joe, man. It's a huge, huge, huge thing. And then to get people to come see it. Like, not in a corner, well, you know, a few people saw it. But like, yeah. Joint, Jesus, it was huge. Is huge, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, for sure, man. But you know, we approached it. Like, I'm curious, like, you sit down and write something, bro. Like, whether it's, because you talked about you were raised in a household that didn't delineate between different forms of art. It was all treated the same in terms of how it was viewed. And for you, you say, like, you know, as a result of that, you can go from journalism to fiction and back. Is your process the same for each one? Are you sitting down? Are you outlining? Are you asking yourself what you're trying to say thematically before you get started? Like what do you, is your process
similar? I think figuring out what similar? I want to say is probably the most important part. I think that's extremely, extremely important. I think, you know what I mean? And then everything kind of flows from there. I was telling my wife the other day, you know, I was working and I was telling her, like, the act of writing, by which I mean, like, the act of me just sitting back with a pad and a pen and just trying to take notes is like an act of discovery for me, because things come that I didn't even know was there. I usually read a lot first. I just spend a ton of time reading. You know what I mean? And just think about, well, what am I feeling? How does this make me feel? What am I seeing here? I usually mark up whatever I'm reading.
Right.
You know, and that goes across the board, journalism, fiction, whatever. I always start off reading.
You start off reading. You know, you're making notes. You're thinking, you're looking for what you're trying to say.
Yeah, what is really, really, really striking me here. And if it's journalism, then that expands out to actually calling people and talking to people. I mean, in fiction, it might too. Sometimes it does in fiction also, as you know. You know, you might need to interview people to talk to them to get, you know, a better sense of things. That comes into the process. I gotta feel, you know how actors like feel like they gotta, you know, really be in the person before they can start really acting. Like, they gotta really, like, know the person. Yeah, I feel like that as a writer.
Totally.
I gotta know it. I mean, and I think that's more important actually than structure and all of the other stuff that I do have to do. But, you know, all of that is like me, like, you know, getting that figured out. But can you actually be in this place and convince yourself that you're there? Forget other people. Do you believe it?
Yes.
Do you believe this happened? You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what you gotta do.
Yeah, it's similar for me, bro. Like, for Fruitvale, it was a real thing. So I was in, like, a journalist mode, you know, like, talking to people who were involved. And then with Creed, I had to, you know, I grew up playing sports, but I had never boxed before. Mm-hmm. So I had to take, you know, I took boxing lessons. Like, went to work out at King's Boxing Gym in East Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Did you spar, Coog?
What I did, I wouldn't call sparring, bro.
Okay.
So I'm going to say no. Yeah, like, cause I say that because I've taken martial arts before and I've sparred before in other martial arts, like in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and Okinawa Karate. I've sparred before. What I was doing in boxing was not that,
mm-hmm.
you know, because mm-hmm. Bro, boxing is such a, bro, it's such a degree of difficulty, bro. Like, it wouldn't have been smart, bro, for me to, because it was nobody in that gym that was as much of a beginner as I was, bro. Right. You know what I'm saying? And they knew that. Even when we was in there, it was never like we were really going. You know what I'm saying?
Did they know you were working on Creed at that point? Did they know? Like, were they aware of what you were doing?
It was people in there who knew who I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple of my old football homies was in there.
Okay.
Who had turned to boxing, okay. like, as a way to stay in shape. They know I was a filmmaker. They didn't know I was making a Rocky movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they knew it had to have been something that brought me in there that wasn't like, oh, I'm just trying to learn how to fight now. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, the act of doing that is what gave me the real, really, like, what I was trying to say with the movie, I think. You know, I kind of knew it would be father and son in this question of masculinity and later on identity. But, like, what we were saying with the fight scenes, you know what I'm saying? Like, what we were actually articulating is that in this sport, you are on your own. You know what I'm saying? Like, you got somebody in a corner talking to you or whatever that you can hear. But when you in that... it's no teammates, you know what I'm saying? It's no, you know, and you in there with the same four things that other person has, which is like 2 feet and 2 hands, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And bro, when you in that ring with somebody who knows what they doing, but that ring is a phone booth. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, it's, cause you could kind of get anywhere at any time. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And them rounds, bro, they last forever, bro. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Like, just in terms of endurance, man. So like, it's so much more than just fighting. The closest thing to it is chess, I would say.
Mm.
You know, like the closest thing to it is chess, on like the world's most relentless treadmill. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, that's why I call it the sweet science or whatever. But I had to get in there to learn it, to understand it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I could actually see what you're saying and how the camera moves.
Yes.
In those scenes now. You know, like you totally see it and how it's shot. I mean, that's, you know.
But also like the one take fight that we did, that was directly as a result of my experience in there and realizing like I want the audience to feel like how long a round is. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
And if another person has your number, like what it's like to try to survive, like till you get back to the other side of the ring. And also what it's like to like, in the sound mix, to like still be trying to hear your coach talking to you while you're getting your ass beat.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like you can really only do that with like an unbroken take. You know what I'm saying?
I love that movie, dude.
Oh, right on.
I done told you like 100 times.
Right on. We tore our Prox Rex segment of the show, man, and man, it's been a fun one, you know, hanging out with my big bro, Coach. And this is when we kind of recommend something for the audiences at home. I'm going to take an easy way out on this one, and I'm going to recommend Beautiful Struggle, which is a novel from Ta-Nehisi. Memoir. Yeah, use the right phrasing. But you'll hear about a lot about how he came up and the inflection points in his life that led him to be one of our most celebrated writers today. You know, you laughing, bro? This is serious, man. Like, I got, you know, that's a big recommendation for
me. I really, really, really appreciate that. I'm laughing because let me just say I'm humble. I'm absolutely humble. I'm absolutely humble. I think because of the field we're in, when I first met Ryan Coogler, when we first talked, speaking as friends, he said one time to me that he had this dream of Hollywood being like the NBA, which is to say the sheer number of Black filmmakers in it, you know, really doing it. And I got on the phone, I said, well, I won't say the language I said, but he said, to sum it up in polite language, I said, this man has lost his faculties. but it stuck with me, right? Like you saying that actually stuck with me. And the fact is, you know, we probably have more Black filmmakers active than at any point. You know, not to say the struggle is over, but we do. It stuck with me so hard. And, you know, as has been a theme in this conversation, whenever we start talking about stuff, it's never confined to like whatever art form you're talking about. Like it becomes like a bigger conversation about the art itself. And so I'm gonna recommend the essays of a gentleman by the name of Alain Locke. Alain Locke was a philosopher. He was the articulator, really, of the philosophies of the literary movement, the Harlem Renaissance, taught at Howard University. I took my first English classes in Locke Hall, named for Alain Locke, where he taught for many years. And I found myself going back to read things that I read when I was a younger person. And what happens is, in the great ones, things that you now just take as religion, things that you just take as laws of the world, as just truth, you can hear folks saying it a century before. And so recently, you know, I read this essay from Alain Locke, and I just want to read this short quote, Cougar. I think I sent this to you because it just made me think of you and what you told me. And Alain Locke writes, "All classes of people under social pressure are permeated with a common experience. They are emotionally welded as others cannot be. With them, even ordinary living has epic depth and lyric intensity. And this, their material handicap, is their spiritual advantage."
Mm.
So in a day when art has run to classes, cliques, and coteries, and life lacks more and more a vital common background, the Negro artist, out of the depths of his group and personal experience, has to his hand almost the conditions of a classical art. And what that brother is saying is, because of how much we've been through, we got the material to do like really, 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 really great things, because you can't be Black in this world, or you can't be among any class that was outside of this world and come to an art form and have nothing to say. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I think, Cool, I think about your work, you know, all the time with that. You know what I mean? And I think about what you told me, you know, all those almost 10 years ago now, you know, with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that, Coach. That's beautiful, man. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks for taking the time to be with us here on Air Proximity. We appreciate all you, good. Bro.
All good. Thank you, bro.
In Proximity is a production of Proximity Media. If you like the show, be sure to follow, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. And tell your friends and loved ones to do the same. Seriously, you can do that right now. Send a link to someone who you think might really like this conversation. Learn more and read transcripts of this episode and others, and get a link to Wakanda Forever, the official Black Panther podcast, on proximitymedia.com. Don't forget to follow at Proximity Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. The show is produced by me, Paula Mardo. Executive producers are Ryan Kugler, Zinzi Kugler, Sev Ohanian, and me. Our theme song and additional music is composed by Ludwig Göransson. Ken Nana is our sound designer and mix engineer. Paulina Cherizova is our production assistant. Audio editing for this episode is by Cedric Wilson. Special thanks to the whole Proximity Media team and to you for listening to In Proximity. Meet you back here next week.
The owners of the gym knew, but I mean, yeah, it was no real sparring happening, bro. Like no real rounds with cash that was in there, bro. I'd have been knocked out.
It's really hard. It's a really, really hard sport. People don't they think you just fight.
Yeah, I'd have been knocked out.